Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. I'm going to tell you a story in which nothing is quite what it seems. A few years ago, a 16-year-old was sick in the hospital with an overdose. And this was not an overdose of pain pills. It was not an overdose of illegal drugs. It was an overdose of antibiotics, which is not usually what you hear about people overdosing on. And it wasn't the overdose that landed him in the hospital. He was already there. He was sick with a chronic condition. It was the hospital that administered the overdose. The doctor didn't actually mean to prescribe the overdose. The hospital pharmacist certainly didn't mean to fill it. And even the nurse who actually handed him the pills one by one did not mean to give a teenager an overdose. You're going to hear more about this story later in the show and what happened to that kid. But here's what happened to one of the prominent doctors at that hospital. He became convinced that this never would have happened if it hadn't been for the increasing power of computers to shape doctors' actions and their decisions. Our whole show this week is about really big problems and how to solve them. Bob Wachter is that bigwig doctor I was talking about, and his concerns led him to write a book called The Digital Doctor. He's also the interim chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Bob, welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's a great pleasure.
So do you think, for most doctors, technology changes what it's actually like to care for patients? And maybe not in the way that they'd have hoped that technology would have helped them.
I'm sure every doctor would say this has changed their work and their life in ways that are deep, profound, and larger than they had expected. I think most would say, as I do, that I'm glad we have these machines in our professional lives, that it's better than it was without them. It's pretty easy when you're thinking about and writing a book about some of the problems to sort of say, let's pull out the cords and bring back the three-ring binders and the post-it notes. That's not right. We have to get to a better place and we have to be digital. But I think most doctors would say this has changed the nature of being a doctor in ways that have more harm and more negative consequences than they had anticipated. Mm. I'd say the biggest one is the direct relationship with patients. You know, if you go in and see your doctor, there's a pretty good chance these days the doctor will ask you a question, and as soon as you start speaking, the doctor's head will be down in his or her laptop,
right,
or even maybe even turn around and have her back to you while typing away. And many of our doctors spend the day doing what they used to do and then go home for 2 or 3 or 4 hours of digital work. Nobody really anticipated that, and there are a lot of people that are pretty unhappy about that.
Well, I actually know a doctor who has told me that, you know, periodically the software will change in the hospital that she's at, and she'll have to go to this really long training. And then when she's done with training and you know, implementing it, that the day feels like thousands of clicks and thousands of screens that you're working through, you know, as you see different patients. And I don't know, I think at least for her, it's a very tiring experience.
It's tiring. And most of us went into medicine because of sort of the meaning and purpose of taking care of people when they're sick. And so it's distracting. It feels like what you're doing is feeding the computer rather than doing what you believe you should be doing, which is paying attention to people and their problems. And some of that's inevitable. You know, we're in a data business, and so the computer has to be fed, and a lot of the information about patients is going to live on the screen. That's inevitable and to some extent is fine. But the degree to which it has shifted the center of gravity from the doctor and the patient sitting knee to knee talking to one another to the doctor and the computer having this deep, intimate, and love-hate would be the best thing you could say about it, relationship, and therefore away from the doctor and the patient relationship. I think that's been surprising to people. It's not all the computer's fault in a way. The computer came in and became an enabler for other parties, regulators, quality measurers, billing mm-hmm. people, malpractice attorneys, to say, okay, now the doctor's on a computer. We can just ask the doctor to record this one more thing. But there are about 100 one more things. And by the time you're done, the average emergency medicine physician clicks about 4,000 times in a 10-hour period.
Oh, my gosh.
And I came upon an ad last year for a doctor at a brand spanking new modern hospital. And the advertisement said, come to our hospital. We have a beautiful hospital and beautiful radiology suite and terrific ORs, and we have no electronic medical record. They were advertising that you could use pen and paper here.
So let's back up and talk for a second about patients who are sick in the hospital. I mentioned earlier the story of a patient in your hospital at the University of California, San Francisco, Pablo Garcia. He was 16 years old, chronic condition, and somehow, through a series of human/technical errors, he ended up getting nearly 40 times the medication that he should have been given. Explain to me how that happens in an age where there should be so many checks on that kind of mistake.
Well, there are, and they all failed. And it was in hearing that story, that was the moment I said, I need to write about this. I was at our patient safety committee meeting, and you'll be reassured to know that when there is an error in a hospital today, we spend a considerable amount of time dissecting it and trying to figure out what happened and where did the system fail. Having been at those kinds of meetings for 20 years, I can tell you that many of those meetings ended up with the final statement being, if we just had computers, this wouldn't have happened. You know, the doctor's handwriting wouldn't have been an issue.
Right.
We would have, you know, the system would have known the patient was allergic to the medicine. So finally, we have computers. We have we're one of the 10 top hospitals in the country. We have the best computer system that a lot of money can buy. And here I heard about this case in which a kid comes into a hospital. He's supposed to get a certain dose of this particular medicine that is one pill twice a day. But because of the way the order is written into the computer system, it's a little bit vague as to whether when you're writing orders for kids, you sometimes write them in the dose per kilogram of body weight, because obviously the dose for a premature infant and the dose for a teenager have to be very different. So you have to give the medicine adjusted by the kid's weight. Because it wasn't really clear on the screen, the doctor was distracted, she ended up writing a dose for the full dose, which then got multiplied by the kid's body weight, which was 39 kilograms or about 80 pounds. The end result turns out to be that is a prescription she wrote for 39 pills. Okay, happens, human error. The system has a lot of built-in protections to prevent a human error, which we all make, from reaching a patient. The first protection is when she clicked to sign the order, an alert fired and basically said it was an overdose. But the alert is incredibly dense, text-heavy, and it turns out the doctors and the nurses get hundreds and hundreds of alerts a day. About 95 to 98% of them are false alarms. And we've all gotten used to saying, yeah, yeah, alert, click out of it, just the same way you do with your I accept button when you download an app. Okay, so it makes it through a doctor, makes it through a pharmacist for both those reasons. In the old days, it would have gone to a person called a pharmacy technician who would have seen an order for 39 pills and would have said, what the hell?
Right.
Tapped the doctor on the shoulder and said, you know, this seems crazy. And the doctor said, oh my God, glad you caught it. Now, of course, it goes to a $7 million robot that when it sees an order for 39 pills says in robot language, thank you. And then the most interesting part of it was it went to a young nurse who was on an unfamiliar floor. There was a shortage in one floor. She was what we call floating. She sees an order for 39 pills. That's a crazy order. That would be like driving on the highway and seeing a sign that said the speed limit was 2,500 miles per hour.
Yeah.
She looks at it and she says, this is weird. And then she starts doing what humans sometimes do, which is to say, it's an unfamiliar floor. The kid, maybe he's on some sort of odd research protocol, but I will check it against my technology. And the technology here is called a barcode, which is no different than what you see in the supermarket. She barcodes pill number one, and the technology says, well, that's not the right dose. The right dose is 39. Why? Because at that stage of the medication safety process, the job of the barcode is to make sure the nurse gives the drug exactly as the doctor and the pharmacist wrote for. And that's just enough of a prompt for her to say to herself, well, I guess it's right. Those are the most dangerous words in medicine, by the way. I guess it's right. And she then tears open 39 shrink wrap packages, puts them in a cup, half fills up a cup, and gives it to this kid who takes every single pill. When I asked her what she was thinking when she gave this kid the 39 pills, she said, well, I thought what a good kid he is to take all of these pills. Mm. And then she stopped for a second and started crying. Because obviously, in retrospect, she knows this is crazy and she knows she shouldn't have done it. But the key is to try to put yourself in her shoes where the technology is telling you something And people defer to the technology because we've gotten so used to it being righter than we are. That's a real danger. So that was the moment I came home that night, and my wife's a journalist, and I said, I have to write about it. And she said, well, the only way to do this is to speak to a whole lot of people. And so I spent the better part of a year speaking to CEOs of tech companies and speaking to the IBM Watson people and going to Boeing and see how they did cockpit computer design and speaking to doctors and nurses and patients, trying to make sense of how this could happen.
Well, I want to talk to you about some of that tech and medicine. But first, just back to one element of your story, the alert. If you give way too much medication, maybe double or triple what the normal dose would be, you would think there would be an alert, and there is. And as you said, there are thousands of alerts all the time in hospitals, whether they're for nurses or for doctors. But people have learned, ignore the alerts.
Exactly. And nobody was crazy here. Part of the challenge of medicine is we have an enormous amount of uncertainty. And so the situations that occur where it's absolutely unambiguously wrong, the patient is allergic to penicillin and the doctor has just written a prescription for penicillin and an alert goes off, those we tend to catch. The problem is the alerts also fire, and it's not unreasonable, the alerts fire when the heart rate seems a little too high, when these two medicines might interact with each other, probably won't, might interact with each other. And so we've calibrated the alerts to go off for a doctor, a nurse, or pharmacist anytime anything might be wrong that we think the person should know. That's not unreasonable. When you're sitting in a conference room planning the alerts, it turns out in real life, what you then do is overwhelm the doctors, nurses, and pharmacists so they stop paying attention to even the important ones. In our intensive care units at UCSF, we have 70 beds. Each bed has a bedside monitor, you've probably seen them, that fires an alert if the heart rate is too high or low, or the blood pressure too high or low, or the oxygen. In a month at UCSF, the alerts go off, an alert or an alarm goes off 2.5 million times.
Oh my God.
There's one every 6 minutes.
And
talking to a nurse about this, and the question was asked, you know, the alerts are going off every 6 or 7 minutes, and it seems kind of crazy. How would you know that something was wrong with your patient? The nurse thought for a second, and then she said, silence. If there was no alert, I'd be really nervous something bad was happening.
Oh, my gosh.
That is, on Seinfeld, they call that bizarro world.
Yeah.
It's completely
yeah.
upside down, but that's the situation we've created.
So let's talk about technology and medicine, because it's not like tomorrow or next week, this is all about to change and technology is going to be departing the medical field. It's just going to get more intense. You talked about IBM Watson, Watson has been used at Memorial Sloan Kettering to help think about cancer diagnosis and all over the place. So what do you think when you see, well, This is the beginning. This is our toe in the water of technology. There's going to be way more tech companies that want a piece of this very, very big industry.
Well, I'm very excited about it. It's funny. Toward the end of the book, I wrote a chapter that a few people said, well, it almost sounded like it was written by a different person, because I came to believe that this is all going to work out. And at the end of the day, patients are going to get care that's better and safer and less expensive because of technology. And we know we have to work out all of these bugs, whether it's the alerts or creating a system where the doctor and the patient actually look each other in the eye again. We know, and we sort of know we'll eventually get there. The question is, how do we make it through this sort of adolescent phase with the minimum amount of carnage? And I just didn't see people having mature discussions about that. They kind of took the polar views of either, you know, it's all great, it's all fine, you know, don't be a Luddite, or let's go back to paper. It's much more nuanced than that. What I came to recognize is that what we're going through is an exaggerated version of what many industries go through when they computerize. There's a concept called the productivity paradox. And the paradox is everybody's expecting computers will come in and make things better and cheaper and standardize stuff. It sounds good. And then they come in and a few years go by and nothing good really happens and everybody scratches their head. In other industries, including financial and travel and retail, it did get much better, but it often takes 10 years. And the 10 years, two things have to happen. One is the technology has to mature and get better. The second is much more interesting, which is the second is that the work has to be reimagined for a digital age. What typically happens is people look at the way they used to do it on paper. They say, okay, we'll put in computers, and they just ape what you did on paper now with computers. Maybe it's a little faster, but it's no better. That's why you need people coming into the industry and they say, why do we do it this way? And the answer is, oh, because we've always done it this way. And they say, no, that's crazy. Let's really reimagine what it's like to be a doctor, a nurse, and probably most importantly, a patient, and use the technology in the service of providing better and safer and less expensive care. And I really do think we're going to get there, but we're in a difficult phase right now.
If you were a patient, and as you say, there are all these new computer systems that even doctors and pharmacists and nurses are wrestling with. What, as a patient, do you think we should be thinking about?
Well, this will seem odd from a guy who just wrote a book about some of the challenges and problems with computerization, but I actually would not go to a hospital today that did not have an advanced electronic medical record, barcoding, smart pumps. I do think on net it makes care better and safer, and it's easy to get romantic about the old days. The old days were pretty bad. I mean, the old days were where you could not read people's writing, you know, the chart got
lost. That was certainly the old joke that doctor's handwriting was illegible, of course.
And no joke. I mean, look at mine. It was terrible. And so I think it's better. I probably would try, if I could, not to go to a hospital that had just implemented a new computer system, because it really does take a year or two to settle in. I think, looking at my own place, you know, having a good system in a hospital that's been using it for 4 or 5 years, I can begin to see the productivity paradox get resolved and begin to see how we're going to end up in a substantially better place than we were in the beginning. But when we put it in, we were really pretty naive about, all right, there's a computer. That's great. We did not think deeply about how it changes everything.
Bob Wachter is a professor. He's the interim chair at the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He is also author of the book Digital Doctor: Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. Bob, thank you so much. This was great.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
We've got a link to the whole story of the 16-year-old that we were talking about who overdosed on antibiotics, and it is a riveting story. That's on our website, innovationhub.org. You can also find this segment to share or to hear again. It's on iTunes and SoundCloud. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.